And a number of his sermons preached in the 400s tackle with this issue. For instance, here is one in 399, where some Christians had in the town of Carthage had participated in a civil celebration in honor of the genius of Carthage. Remember the genius of the emperor, the spirit imbuing the emperor here, the spirit then imbuing the pagan spirit imbuing Carthage. Augustine was forthright in condemning a mixture of Christianity and Roman paganism. If I'm weighed down by one great sorrow, it is sorrow over Christians, over my brothers, who enter the church in their bodies but leave their hearts outside. All must come within the church, body and soul. Why should the body, which is seen by men, be within, or that which is seen by God is left outside? We certainly do preach against idols. It is from the heart we want to uproot them. And Augustine would have concurred with Calvin when the latter said that the human heart is a factory of idols. And some of the Christians argued, well, the festival was simply harmless. It was just a cultural event. There was no idolatry involved. Augustine pleaded with them this way. You say, we know he's no God, that is the genius of Carthage. Would that they, the pagans, knew it too. But for the sake of the infirm who do not know this, you must not trouble their consciences. How do you think you can avoid people being taken in by idols whom they assume to have been honored by Christians? You may say, God knows my heart. All right, but your brother doesn't know it. If you are infirm, beware of falling into more serious illness. If you are healthy, beware of causing your brother to fall ill. Participation, then, in Augustine's mind, would not only cause problems for them, but it would offend weak Christian consciences. It would also prevent pagans being confronted with Christian truth. We want to bring in the remaining pagans, in other words, to bring them to faith in Christ. You are rocks in their path. They will say in their heart, why should we leave the gods whom Christians worship along with us? And so there is clearly an evangelistic thrust here in his attempt also to bring reform. Augustine dies in the year 430 on the 28th of August. And he dies in a state of with a city in a state of siege. Because in the 420s, and we'll look at this in detail in the next hour. In the 420s, the Roman Empire begins to fall apart in the West. And a group known as the Vandals. The Vandals originally came from Denmark. The area we know today is Denmark. They had fought their way through Gaul, through Hispania, and across the Straits of Gibraltar, what we call the Straits of Gibraltar, and landed in North Africa and began to carve out a kingdom in North Africa. In fact, it'll become the Vandal Kingdom of North Africa. And in the summer of 430, as Augustine is dying, they are besieging the city. And but Augustine's mind is quite elsewhere. And he's now thinking of the city of God. And he asks that there be written out on paper, papyrus, and pasted on the wall a number of the penitential psalms. That as he's leaving this world, he's thinking of the world to come and of God's mercy on him as a sinner. Shortly after his death, they captured the city. There was respect for Augustine, even among them, because they did not do what they had often done in other cities, which is pillage and destroy everything, because his library is preserved. And by 439, they had conquered Carthage and established a kingdom that would last well into the period just before the Muslims take all of this area. Well, any questions before that's looking then at Augustine's life? Any questions before we stop? And then the next hour, what we'll do is we'll go through the city of God, and I'll lay out the background and then also take you through a whiz tour of the city of God.
Sorry?
Now, if you remember, first of all, Augustine is not, he would not have been comfortable with much of what becomes Roman Catholicism in the Middle Ages. He would have definitely not. The two central features of Roman Catholicism are the Mass and the papacy. And Augustine has no time for the idea that the Pope, Bishop of Rome, is superior to anybody else, or all the other bishops. And then he also would not have been committed to the doctrine of the Mass, because he did not believe in what we would describe as transubstantiation. As a persecutor, the matter is ambiguous in this sense, is that Augustine certainly, in using Luke 14:23, lays an ideological foundation for persecution in the Middle Ages. He himself, at that point in time, there is not a tremendous amount of that happening in his day, but he certainly favors the use by the church of state force to compel those who are schismatics from the state church, for the church which is recognized by the state to come into their assemblies. So in that sense, yes, he lays that foundation, but pretty well everybody in the fourth century, once there has been this acceptance of Christianity by the state, there is this union that is now being welded together, and it's very difficult for most of these individuals to rise above the idea of a state church union. I mean, even when you get into the Reformation, I mean, one of the challenges for men like Calvin and Luther is to break from that, and they don't. They don't fully break from that at all. So,
in his book on the Trinity, he thinks that reason is, we should not understand it, Trinity is through reason or...
Well, what he does in the first part is what he's doing really is laying bare the limits of human reason in thinking about the Trinity. And so he spends eight books, pretty well, at least seven books, books 2 to 8, doing that. He talks about various models of how we understand the Trinity, and finally comes to the model of there's within man a tripartite structure, which is a reflection, because we are in the image and likeness of God, a reflection of the triunity of God. But, and a lot of scholars end there, who are interested in philosophical theology. But actually, Augustine goes on in Book 9 and following to indicate that this really hardly exhausts the case, and that to understand the Trinity, we have to have recourse primarily to Scripture, and that reason has significant limitations on understanding the Godhead. I've never thought of that. I'd have to think about that, whether his misunderstanding of justitia, justification, is linked to that. For Augustine, definitely justification is justification for Augustine is sanctification and justification roll together. So in justifying us, God is it's not the external righteousness, it's not the imputation of Christ's righteousness, but it's rather the process of what we call sanctification, and there is confusion there. That's clear. Some of Augustine's problem there is linguistic. That's no doubt about that. The Latin, old Latin Bible that he was using did not adequately convey the Greek. And I'll need to think about whether or not what you said there about the conversion account reflects some of that. Okay, it's 10:30. Let's break till 10:45, and then when we come back, actually let's break till 10 to 11, and then when we come back, we'll go right through to noon. And it's not simply a response to an event of history, even though that event would have enormous consequences for the West. But it's also an issue that relates to theodicy, justification of the ways of God in history. And now scholars have long reflected on, debated the reasons behind the so-called fall of the Western Roman Empire. And there are a multitude of suggestions, ranging from things that we would regard as somewhat ridiculous to the extremely plausible. Climactic change has been attributed, lead poisoning the aristocracy. One writer argued that the Romans aristocracy into fresh water, the piping in of fresh water came through lead piping. Sometimes the lead flaked off into the water. Lead builds up in the bodies, causing insanity, imbecility, and infertility. And this is therefore what led to the fall of the empire. The aristocracy, unable to think properly, unable to have those to succeed them. Excessive government bureaucracy, the demise of the urban middle class, a host of things. My own tendency is to see it as a military issue, and the inability of the Roman Empire to secure the defense of the borders, and so on. Now, there has been a significant debate in very recent times, and you can see this in a number of the textbooks that are used, for example, in standard college and university histories on the Roman Empire, in which there is the argument made that actually the Roman Empire never actually really fell. It didn't collapse at all. What there was a transformation taking place in Western Europe from a period in which Romans ruled, in which now there was a kind of quasi-Romanized Germanic kingdoms. It was more of a transition from the antiquity to the early Middle Ages. And again, I think I'm following here a man named Ward Perkins. I detail all of this in the notes that you'll get in the digital version. This really doesn't, again, account for the experience of the men and women at the time. That is not what they talk along the lines of. There's no sense of peaceful transition going on here. It's a very unpleasant experience when these various barbarian groups erupt into the empire, and the terms collapse, demise, end, those are the phraseologies that dominate the literature of the period written about what the people were experiencing. And for example, in 378, I'm going to document a number of events which are vital to understand, which lie behind Augustine's having to write what we call the City of God. In 378, I've already mentioned this actually when we looked at the Emperor Valens, a persecutor of the church, an Arian, and his persecution of Athanasius. But in 378, Valens was defeated at Adrianople. Adrianople is in the Balkan Peninsula, and he was defeated by a combined force of Goths, Visigoths, and Huns. And when Ambrose heard of that defeat, he could say, "The end of the world is coming." Hardly any idea of transition here. We live, he said, in the wane of the age, the close of the age. Or again, Jerome, when he heard of the Huns, fresh invasions of the Huns in the Eastern Roman Empire, he could basically say, the Roman world is falling apart. And that could only mean one thing for him, the end of history. Now, Adrianople was a major, major defeat for the Roman army. Somewhere in the vicinity of half to two-thirds of the legions stationed in that part of the Eastern Empire were destroyed at this particular battle. And the cause of the battle was Roman imperial policy as it related to that area, which is really the area today of Romania, Bulgaria, and the Danube running through them. In the 370s, by that period of time, Rome had abandoned Dacia, which was on the other side of the Danube, north of the Danube, and withdrawn to the south of the Danube, using the Danube River as a barrier. The people on the other side of the river were the Goths, divisible into two groups, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. The Visigoths, like basically the Western Goths, the Ostrogoths, the Eastern Goths. The Visigoths were Arians, and the Ostrogoths were pagan. The Visigoths had, if you want to use this phrase, been evangelized by a man named Ulfila, an Arian in the 350s who had left what is now really the area of modern Turkey, had gone into the area of Dacia and evangelized the Visigoths. Interesting, he produced actually the first Bible translated into a Germanic language. It's known as the Gothic Bible. There are still copies of this. Nobody speaks Gothic today. One of the things that he did do, which is of a curious note, is that when he came to a lot of the Old Testament texts that dealt with war, he figured the Goths were already warlike enough, and so what he would do with those, he didn't translate those, but had a brief précis of parts of the Old Testament, which he didn't translate at all, not wanting to encourage the Goths in their warlikeness. But the Goths, the Visigoths were Arian. This will play a role in the actual fall of Rome, because it's the Visigoths who take the city under Alaric in 410. Now, the Visigoths were right on the border above, right on the border of the Roman Empire, right above the Danube. In the 350s, 360s, there appeared from the Russian steppes, coming out of the area that today we would describe as Russia, and then beginning to put pressure on them, a group of people known as the Huns. And the Huns were terrifying to the Romans for a number of reasons. Number one, the Huns were probably the first Oriental people that the Romans had ever met. They were not Caucasian. The Romans were very familiar with all the various Caucasian groups in Europe, the various African groups, Middle Eastern groups. The Huns, though, were Oriental. And their origin would be back, probably in the area around Mongolia, that area, the steppes, the Central Asia. They had migrated this far. They come in and begin to put pressure on the Goths. They were also horrifying to the Romans in terms of language. The Romans never really developed the ability to interact with them. But the most critical reason why the Romans found the Huns terrifying was because the Huns had perfected the ability of, at least the men, had perfected the ability of riding a horse without the use of their hands. They didn't use their hands to ride the horse. They could turn the horse everything with their legs. What this meant was that the hands were free to do all kinds of other things in battle, which is primarily fire arrows. And the Romans had never really developed cavalry. Diocletian had brought them in, but the Roman cavalry was not certainly up to the military capacity of combat with the Huns. And we have accounts of what it's like to be a Roman soldier, a legionnaire, at the receiving end of a charge of Hunnic cavalry. And it was horrifying to the Romans. And the Huns appear, put pressure on the Goths. The Huns are basically looking for land. The Goths asked the Romans, could they come over into the area south of the Danube? The Roman imperial policy basically is in their minds, at this point, is trying to eliminate as many enemies as they can. And they see it a great opportunity to eliminate the Goths. And so they tell the Goths, yes, they can come over, and they begin to ferry them over. But in the process of ferrying them over, policy was that they were to take all of their armament away. And for the Goths, like most of the Germanic people in this period, they are nomadic warriors, hunters, not an urban culture. And this was a devastating blow to their livelihood, to their pride, and they are determined to get back at the Romans. There is now a large Gothic contingent within the empire. They make some overtures to the Huns. They forge an alliance, and thus there comes about the event known as the Battle of Adrianople, which the battle is completely lost to the Romans. Anywhere between a half to two-thirds of the Roman legions in that part of the Eastern Roman Empire are completely decimated. Valens himself takes refuge in a hut, is found, and the hut is burned down, and he perishes. Now, at that point, the barrier has been breached, and you have the significant numbers of Goths and Huns basically loose, pillaging throughout the Balkans and throughout parts of Italy. And during the early 400s, on three occasions, the Ostrogoths seek to come down, are repelled. They are repelled, by all people, by a Vandal. And the Roman, this I think is indicative of the inability of the Roman army to cultivate their own generals. Stilicho was a Vandal. His father was a Roman, his mother was a Vandal. And he was basically a mercenary in the Roman army. And he commanded the legions defending northern Italy and defeated the Ostrogoths three times on three occasions. Then there is, not surprisingly, given these large number of barbarians' incursions into the empire, there is an anti-barbarian reaction in the upper-class circles in the Roman Empire at the center of power in Ravenna. And Stilicho is not trusted by many. He is arraigned on various charges of treason and executed. He was actually the last man who probably could have defended Italy from the Goths. And not surprisingly, the next time the Goths come down, which is the Visigoths, all of the Italian peninsula lies open to them, and Rome is taken after a three-day siege in 410. Now, the Visigoths are Arians, and what that means is when they break into the city, they do not destroy churches. They're Arians. They don't believe in the Orthodox Trinitarian view, but at least they will guarantee churches as places of sanctuary. And so you have this very interesting picture of pagans scurrying as much as they could carry for the sanctuary and safety of churches. And Augustine will use this as an argument as to, because the pagans will ask the question, will raise the point, the reason why all of this has come upon us is because we no longer worship the old gods. All of our military troubles is because the Christians are running the show. And Augustine will have a response to them. But the fall of Rome is symbolic. It raises the issues of theodicy. But the real issue of the fall of the Roman, the real moment of collapse, the moment of irretrievable disaster, is in the year 406 to 407. And so in 410, then, is the fall of Rome. By the way, later in that century, in the 450s, Rome will be sacked again, this time by the Vandals coming from North Africa. But 410 is remembered as the key event. But the real moment of irretrievable disaster is 406, 407, where somewhere in the vicinity of 200,000 Germanic warriors cross the Rhine. Now, if you remember, one of the things I emphasized was that the Rhine in Roman experience never, ever froze. Well, it did that winter. And in fact, this is the scholars who argue that the Roman Empire fell because of climatic change. There is an element of a grain of truth in that, because Europe is now entering a mini ice age, if you can describe it that way. Remains to be seen whether or not global warming is true at all. But there are cycles of cold and warmth that various parts of the earth go through. And Europe was beginning to enter a period in which the winters would be much more colder than they had hitherto been. And the Romans had never known the Rhine to freeze, but it froze that winter. And obviously stayed frozen, because every day below zero, below freezing point, would thicken the amount of ice. And it stayed frozen for sufficiently long enough that 200,000 German warriors crossed the river. Now, did they come in to destroy the empire? Most of them probably not. Most of them probably came in. Some of them came in for plunder. Some of them came in to actually probably want to be assimilated into the empire. Rome, even the, for many of the Germanic barbarians, Rome was the epitome of all that they wanted to be. The problem was, though, there was no way Rome could assimilate that large a number of warriors. That's about women, children, other families. And that's the moment of disaster. And Gaul is soon overrun by a groups, the Franks, where France comes from, Burgundians, Lombards, Alans, you don't need to remember all these, Suevi, the Vandals, the Visigoths, who will take Rome, eventually end up in Spain. And they basically create a kingdom in Spain, the Visigothic kingdom, which for about 50 to 60 years is Arian. Actually, for about 100 years, it's an Arian kingdom in Visigothic Spain. The Vandals, we've already seen, take North Africa. The Lombards come down to Italy, take most of Italy. The Franks and the Burgundians carve up France, what becomes France, what we know as what the Romans do as Gaul. And then at the end of the 5th century, the Angles and the Saxons would cross. The Angles and Saxons coming from the area that we would describe today as Frisia, or the parts of Denmark, cross the North Sea and land in Britain or Britannia. There are three legions in Britannia in 406, three Roman legions. They all leave, all of them leave, to repel the invasion. None of them ever comes back. And from that point on, Britannia is defenseless. And that'll play part of our story with Patrick. Now, how to react to all this? The pagans, the devastation for pagans is illustrated by the fact that virtually no Roman historian alive at the time who was a pagan mentions all these events. Just completely stunned. For the Christians, there are a number of reactions, and I want to run through these very, very quickly. There is, for instance, the reaction of a man named Paulus Orosius. Paulus Orosius was a young man that Augustine knew. He asked him if he could do some research for him, assemble research in terms of Roman history, because Augustine begins to work on the city of God in 413. And there's far more there. What begins as a reflection on the fall of Rome soon grows and grows and grows, and it becomes Augustine's reflection on history, and particularly the history of Rome. He's well suited to do this. He had memorized large amounts of the great Roman writers like Wergil or Virgil or Cicero or any of the other writers that were very familiar figures. And it was stored in his mind. And he begins to go back and try to... What's God been doing in Roman history? He needs somebody to help, and more than one person. And so he asked Paulus Orosius if Paulus Orosius could help him. And in the process, Paulus Orosius ends up writing his own response to the fall of Rome. And he basically says, look, the thing could be a lot worse. It's not as bad as everybody's making out. And he says, Rome's gone through tough times. Before, and things aren't really that bad. Now, some writers, shortly after 9/11, some writers compared, and I've got a couple of articles, one of them done, a very astute article done by a man named David Wright, who's done a lot of work on baptismal theology in the patristic period. And David Wright wrote an article comparing 9/11 to 410 and Christian reactions to that. And one can imagine how a person would have been treated after 9/11 if somebody had come forward publicly and said, look, it's really not that bad. You know, we've had Pearl Harbor before. It's really no big sweat. You know, nothing to get worked up about. You know, we'll just bounce back after this. It's no big deal. And Pilate is completely, utterly unrealistic. It fails to take into serious consideration the enormity of the event, of what was taking place, the massiveness of suffering that was going on in the Roman Empire. And so that's one reaction. This is very optimistic, but an optimism to the point of unreality. At the opposite end of the spectrum is a man named Salvian. Now, he's a bit after this period, and I've actually given you a text by him. I'm not going to take the time to read it. It's in the back of this, and on the government of God, in the back of the notes on Augustine. There, the Twilight of Antiquity, Jerome, Augustine, and the Fall of the Western Roman Empire. And what Salvian basically says, he is an... Number one, he's an utter pessimist. And second, he praises the nobility of the pagans, rather the barbarians. And he is an elder in Gaul. He experienced firsthand the invasions. And his argument is, look, it's a good job, Rome... Rome needs to get wiped off the face of the earth anyway. I mean, it's just a sinkhole of immorality. And we're just getting what our sins deserve. And the truth of the matter is, these barbarians, they may be pagans, but they are noble, virtuous men. And again, it's... if there had been an infrastructure to arrest people for treason, he might have gotten himself arrested for treason. He basically says, look, Rome deserves everything she's getting. And again, that was not the standard Roman Christian perspective. I won't go into details, but I remember being, shortly after 9/11, I was at a birthday party of a relative, and there is in my family one of my female relatives married a man of Indian extraction who hates the West. And I don't know how many times I've listened to him, long tirades against Britain or against Israel or against America on this particular occasion. And I remember being at this party and I was kind of squashed into a room with a variety of his friends and had to listen for best part of 2 hours to just a tirade against America and why America deserved this and good times you got it coming. And it was horrific. And that's Salvian's perspective, you know. This is the judgment of God. We deserve it. In fact, would that God would rid the world of the Romans and bring in these virtuous, noble barbarians. Now, these are the extremes. The more typical reaction is Jerome, is utter devastation is really what he is. For Jerome, he could say, the whole world is sinking into ruin. Or he could say, I've been so absolutely overwhelmed, I can only weep. To another, he stated, 2 Thessalonians 2:7, must be happening. That's the coming of the Antichrist. The Antichrist is at hand. And then he quotes, and I've given all the details in the digital version of the notes. He quotes the pagan poet Lucan, first century pagan poet Lucan. In one of his poems, Lucan had said this, if Rome be weak, where shall we look for strength? And Jerome takes that and modifies the words to say this, if Rome perishes, how shall we look for help? And what Jerome typifies the product after 100 years of Eusebian imperial theology. Eusebius, the high point of God's activity in history is the creation of the Christian Roman Empire. And for Eusebius, now, to be Roman is to be Christian, and vice versa. And Jerome is the product of that environment. He cannot envisage the kingdom of God without Rome. Rome is vital to the purposes of God in his day. If Rome goes, well, it's got to be the end of history. It's obvious. And I read the passage earlier in this week of Psalm 78, which he quotes, O God, the nations have come into your inheritance. They've defiled your holy temple. They've made Jerusalem an orchard. They've given the dead bodies of your servants to be meat unto the birds of the sky, the flesh of your saints to be to the beasts of the earth. They've shed their blood like water around Jerusalem, and there was none to bury them. Now, obviously, the psalmist, in the original context, is talking of Jerusalem, the center of worship under the Old Covenant. Jerome sees no incongruity in applying it without any sense of the infelicity of the incongruity of applying it to Rome of his day. It's an amazing, amazing application. And to me, that says, that little piece of exegetical application sums up the entire worldview of Jerome when it comes to this issue. For him, the church and Rome are wedded together. And as I said earlier, this is a complete contrast to Christianity prior to the advent of Constantine. I mentioned the example of Tertullian. Another example is in the Acts of the Skeleton Martyrs, where they are on trial for their faith, and they're urged to sacrifice to the emperor. One of the Christians, a man named Sparata, says, I do not recognize the empire of this world. I serve that God whom no man sees nor can see with his eyes. And the relationship of church and empire in the pre-Constantinian period is completely different from Jerome. For Jerome, the church now is wedded to the empire, such that if the empire ceases, the church must be at the end of her earthly pilgrimage. The Antichrist is is waiting in the wings of history, about to come on the stage, and he's devastated. He's absolutely devastated. Now, in my notes there, I spend some time actually going through Eusebian imperial theology. I also get into another sketch of Augustine's life. But what you have here then is Jerome. What Jerome has done is he has baptized or Christianized Roman convictions about their empire. And very interesting. In the first century, one of the great Roman writers is a man named Virgil. And Virgil writes a book called the Aeneid. It becomes kind of a myth of origins for the Roman state. And Virgil, actually, in one of the lines in the poem, the Roman god Jupiter says this about the Rome: I set no limits to their fortune and no time. I give them empire without end. A Christian author, this is typical, this is this old attitude, a Christian author named Prudentius, who lived from 348 to 405, he takes that very text and he says this: Shall we then doubt that Rome, being dedicated to you, O Christ, placed under your governance with all her people and foremost citizens, is now extending her earthly realm beyond the lofty stars of the great firmament? In other words, Rome, just as Virgil said, for men like Jerome, Prudentius, Rome has no limit. And if the limit now has been reached, it must be the end of the world. No wonder the shock of what was going on in the fall of Rome. Augustine, over against all this, Augustine has what we might describe as biblical realism.